Well, 1 week from tonight, we'll remind our listeners that Current State's next pop-up stories event happens, and it turns out we have room for a couple more storytellers. Call of the Wild is our theme, so we want true first-person stories told that involve encounters with wildlife in the outdoors. It all happens at Valley Court Park, East Lansing, 7 p.m. until 8:30 or so. And if you'd like more information or reach us here about participating or just to listen, all the information is on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. We hope you'll consider it. We hope you'll join us 1 week from tonight. A few Lansing neighborhoods have recently received money for investing in improving their parts of town. The money comes from the state of Michigan through LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. Southwest Lansing was awarded some of that money. Meetings have already taken place to determine next steps and possible projects. Here to update us on this Southwest Lansing initiative and to discuss other issues facing South Lansing are the founder of the organization Rejuvenating South Lansing, Elaine Wombolt, along with Melissa Kwan Huber, president of the Averill Woods Neighborhood Association. Elaine, Melissa, welcome back.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
We'll get to the grant and what's on your agenda here and what you're thinking about, but first I want to ask you about this hubbub Tuesday night. There was a meeting at the South Washington Park housing complex where some number of people, including a reporter and I believe a member of your group, Rejuvenating South Lansing, were asked to leave the meeting. First, can you tell us whose meeting this was and what it was about?
About a year and a half ago when we first started Rejuvenating South Lansing, there was a number of people that talked about the problems at 3200 South Washington. And so we made it a priority to get involved because they are neighbors and they are a community.
You don't consider it South Lansing, but you consider them neighbors. Is
well,
that it?
They're in the Southwest Ward 3.
Okay.
So they're in South Lansing.
Okay.
And they've had crime and bed bugs and health issues, and there was a murder there.
Right.
And so what we've been doing is giving them support and trying to help them get stronger as a group and try to make some changes through the Lansing Housing Commission and HUD. I've attended different meetings, including one that was at the mayor's office, and he had requested that we be involved with the 3200 when they are trying to develop a neighborhood association / neighborhood watch. So they had HUD and Lansing Neighborhood Council or Commission had this meeting, which Carol Wood already had a public safety meeting the same time. But on Monday, Patricia Baines Lake sent an email out that she couldn't have the public safety meeting there and that non-residents were not going to be allowed. Our councilman, Ward 3, Adam Hussein, had talked to Tony Baltimore, who is the president of the board there, and he said that we could attend. I went as Carol Wood's guest, and Kathy Miles went as Adam Hussein's guest, but we were told we had to leave because we were non-residents, and they also made the advocates of the residents leave. Some of the people that were family members, and when I was walking out the door, I heard a woman arguing with one of the guys saying, "Hey, look, I'm this person's legal guardian. I have to stay. He doesn't understand what's happening." But
this was a meeting of the board at the housing complex.
Yes.
Itself.
It really is confusing to me. It is funded by federal money,
yeah,
which is a public
it's
building.
It's public, yeah.
And the residents also invited us. And I had different residents coming up and thanking Rejuvenating South Lansing for supporting them. And one lady thanked me for giving her the courage to stand up.
You attended the meeting and were asked to leave?
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yes.
It's now Thursday.
Yes.
What have we learned since? Have you learned anything since Tuesday about why this happened and what's going to happen?
At the meeting, Patricia Barnes Lake had said that if there was one person in the group of residents that did not want the non-residents or the press there, which Eric Lacey was invited
to. The Lansing State Journal. Yeah.
He was invited, and he had to leave also. Mm. And she took a vote, and there was only one person that said they didn't want us there, and everybody else wanted us there.
So it appears there's this territorial vibe going on.
Exactly.
Here. Some people feel this should be a gathering of only the residents, and other people feel a publicly funded wider issue. The public should genuinely be involved. Melissa,
I think that ties into exactly what the issue has been all along, is that residents have felt that they haven't been heard, their voices have been silenced, they've been worried about being able to speak out. So it concerns us on the south side that those residents had an opportunity to have support, and it was seemingly
you were there in
away.
A supportive role, role.
No, we were going to just sit and listen, so we could then work with some of the issues. And they really lost a golden opportunity to reach out and everybody join together and collaboratively find some solutions for the problems, because there are people that are living there that are actually, they're afraid of their life. And mm-hmm. some of them are trying to move out. And I don't care who you are, you have a right to quality of life, safety, and health issues.
Have you heard anything from Ms. Baines Lake since Tuesday night?
No, and I think there's ongoing questions. Many of us have concerns about whether or not this is a violation of Open Meetings Act. So there's some work to try assess that situation.
I'm speaking with the founder of Rejuvenating South Lansing, Elaine Wombolt, along with Melissa Kwan Huber, the voice you last heard. She is the president of the Averill Woods Neighborhoods Association. We will move on to the original reason why we invited you here, and that was to discuss how you might put $50,000 to work here in Southwest Lansing. This is federal money that came through LEAP to your neighborhood here. Was the money earmarked? Can it go only toward a particular project?
Well, I think it's important to note that money has actually been already earmarked and spent for the consultants who are working with the project. So there's hope that at the end of this project we'll have some specific initiatives or ideas or things that we would want to go after for grant money or other leveraging other funds so that we can do some implementation, because that's really where we want to go with this. We've had a lot of organizations that have been doing planning and listening to residents and doing visioning processes. So we're trying to pull all that together with what the consultants are doing and help us
to really develop
a plan.
Who are the consultants?
Kunch Solutions out of Grand Ledge.
Okay. And can you tell us at all, anything at all, about the kinds of projects that they are looking at or that you would like to see?
What we've done is we've had leadership teams, and we are part of that. But and we had our first community meeting that was the end of June, where we brought in residents and community leaders. And they had the opportunity to put up on the boards different ideas that they would like to see to happen in this specific area of Southwest Lansing, which is south of 496, Mount Hope, down MLK, across to Miller.
Okay.
And that's the area it falls in. And through that, then, we have the input on what type of businesses they would like, what type of events they would like to happen, some of the problem areas. And from that, it was thought that homes and Oh, geez. I went
Pleasant
blank.
Grove?
Yes, Pleasant Grove. Mountain Pleasant Grove would be a center because there is so much, there's been crime there. There's just all kinds of problems there. So we'd like to start in that area to try to bring in some new businesses. Now, nothing has been decided. We're going to have another community meeting in early August, and there we'll bring back the community and community leaders, and we'll discuss what all's happened in our second stage of developing.
On your first visit, this is your second visit together here to Current State. On your first visit, that was a focus of what you had to share back then, was souping up the economic, was souping what the diversity of businesses. And I know I think there was a concern about too many medical marijuana businesses.
Yes, we have even more now. We've got over 70 in the city of Lansing.
Yeah.
And Melissa's been working on her her program with restaurants. And I'll let her talk a little about that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think couple of things that are happening, I think, with this initiative that relates to both what Rejuvenating South Lansing is doing and what the South Lansing Community Development Association is doing. So all three of the groups are kind of partnering together and figuring out what we can work on together. So that South Lansing Community Development Association has been working to talk to businesses and find out what kind of things would be useful for them and helping them to grow their businesses. And then on our end, what we're working on with our survey of restaurants is to try and develop clustering of restaurants together, because when restaurants are clustered together, they have more draw than if just one alone. And it's really important because on our side of town, it's in Southwest Lansing, we have $500 million of economic buying power, and we've spent almost $23 million on food out eating out at restaurants. And for the first time last year, residents across the country, people have spent more money eating out than buying groceries.
So you've got a commercial, there's an emphasis here on economic development.
Mm-hmm. As well as, that's a big portion. And then there's also the issues that are like creating the conditions to help the community thrive and grow. And so there's economic development and there's community development. So it remains to be seen which areas we're going to be targeting first and what order. But those are both important parts.
What kind of community development here? The economic development aside for just a second, the community development, what does Southwest Lansing need?
We one of the things that we really want to have is like a community center where seniors can come, families can come, and to develop programs for the youth. We believe that the youth needs to have some organized activities in various areas, and not just in the sporting areas, in the science areas, in different in art areas, and different things like that. And we want to have that center be the area where families can come in and do different things if they want to.
This is a community center, Elaine? I mean, we're talking about a center. What kind of center here?
We're looking for a
public building or public?
Well, we don't know. We're looking at funds. We're in a dream stage somewhat. But ideally, if we could, this community center would be an area where they could have recreational sports. Maybe they would have an area that is set up for seniors where they could come in and gather and receive any type of information or socialization. As you know, we have the river trails and river walks and that, and that's been an important part in South Lansing altogether, because people love to get out. And so these are some of the things that we're talking about. And we want to improve our infrastructure. We want to help with the crime. I mean, we get a lot of thoughts about crime, but we are 60% of the residents that live in South Lansing.
Do you feel you're ably represented on the city council? You mentioned Adam Hussein.
Oh, right. Adam has been a firecracker for us.
Okay.
I mean, I think 3200 South Washington was brought up to the forefront and it's on the front burner largely because of him. And he's been very active in making sure we have lots of partners here at the table for these initiatives.
And Councilman Wood and Council Member Washington and Council Member Judy Brown Clark.
We have to leave it there. We had a long list of other topics I wanted to get to, but the what happened here at South Washington.
It's important to talk about.
It's important. I wanted to get that out on the table, so we ended up talking about that.
We'll come back whenever you want.
I did want to ask you about the First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason. We will save that for another visit. I want to thank our guests. We've been speaking with the founder of Rejuvenating South Lansing, Elaine Wombold, along with Melissa Kwan Huber, president of the Averill Woods Neighborhood Association. Thank you both for being here. Good
thank
luck.
You for having us.
Well, today's the final day of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Coming up on Current State, Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News has been covering the Michigan delegation there. He will join us to talk about the proceedings. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We're all familiar with the phrase, like finding a needle in a haystack. Even if you've never actually searched for said needle, you can probably imagine how difficult that task can be. Now imagine the needle has wings and the haystack's a couple hundred acres wide. That pretty much sums up the environmental expedition that Current State's Kevin Lavery went on recently. Kevin joined a team of experts in search of a tiny butterfly that's made it onto the U.S. Endangered Species list. Kevin, what were you looking for, and did you find it?
I'm happy to tell you its name, Mark, but you'll have to listen to my story to get your answer.
Okay.
The group I joined was looking for a butterfly called the Palshiek skipperling. Here's how rare this is. It's found only in about a half a dozen places on Earth. Two-thirds of them are in Michigan. In fact, all of those sites are in one specific region. So I went on a field trip to a landscape that looks nothing like anything I've ever seen anywhere else in Michigan.
Not far from I-75 near Holly, the Big Valley Nature Sanctuary lies in secluded splendor. The sprawling fingertips of Metro Detroit don't quite reach this little strip of wilderness. And the Michigan Nature Association, the conservation nonprofit which manages this and 170 other sanctuaries across the state, wants it to stay that way. Dan Kennedy pulls his state vehicle off the dirt road to park. He's the Endangered Species Coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Few people know as much about the elusive butterfly we've come here to find.
The Palshiek only occurs in six places on the planet.
Six. There's a small colony in Wisconsin, one in Manitoba, and four in Michigan. All four are here in Oakland County.
That's amazing to me that it's in such an isolated pocket, especially so close to Metro Detroit, too.
Yeah, so the Palshiek occurs in unique wetland systems called the prairie fen, and Oakland County is a great place to find a prairie fen.
Oakland County also seems to be in the landing path here for Detroit Metro Airport.
Yeah, we do have an airplane going over our heads right now.
That's the human ecosystem.
Right, in action.
I grew up in Kansas, so I know what a prairie is, but a prairie fen? I'd never heard the term. But Andy Bacon knows this territory well. He's the stewardship coordinator for the Michigan Nature Association and one of my guides on this trek.
There's multiple kinds of fens in Michigan. The thing that's common amongst all of them is that they're fed by a constant stream of groundwater, which makes them a consistent hydrology and a consistent colder temperature due to the groundwater that's coming up. So as a result, there's an assemblage of different species that you find in these fen wetlands that you don't find in other wetlands around the state. With that being the case, we also tend to get assemblages of rare species that we don't find in other wetlands as well, making these truly unique systems across the landscape of Michigan.
Big Valley is a remnant of Michigan's ancient geology. Dan Kennedy says the glaciers that gouged out the Great Lakes tracked right across this terrain.
14,000 years ago, we would have been under a couple hundred feet of ice right here. Where we're standing here in Oakland County is a unique area because this is where two glaciers met. And that area goes basically from the northeast part of Oakland County down to the northeast part of Hillsdale County. And when those glaciers met, that created an area that deposited a lot of sand and gravel and created a lot of moraines. And that's a pretty coarse material where water can easily flow through it. where it finds an impermeable surface and comes out of the ground, that tends to be where we have that groundwater flow and creates our prairie fence.
Dan, Andy, and I set out. We're joined by two Central Michigan University grad students. Doctoral candidate Rachel Hackett is a botanist specializing in prairie fens, and Clint Pogue is wrapping up his master's degree at CMU, but working this summer as a technician with the Michigan Natural Features Inventory. It's still dry along our path toward the fen. Wildflowers bask in the sun of this nearly cloudless day. But as unspoiled as this setting may seem, it's not immune to invaders. Andy Bacon points to one unwelcome weed that's made its home among the natives.
At Big Valley particularly, one of the big emerging threats is black swallowwort, which is a European species that is very aggressive in northwestern Oakland County and has been spreading rapidly over the past decade. So every year at Big Valley, we go through with teams of volunteers and we apply herbicide to all of the black swallowwort that we can find throughout the entire sanctuary to make sure that it doesn't completely overtake the understory within the oak barrens and the forests that are located on the site. We know that when that does happen, it does so at the complete exclusion of virtually every other plant in the understory, because it is a very aggressive plant.
So it essentially chokes out the other plants as a competitor for resources, whether that's soil or water?
Correct. That's exactly what black swallowwort, as well as many other invasive plants, tend to do.
And not just harmful to other plants, says the DNR's Dan Kennedy.
It's actually really detrimental to monarch butterfly, because they think it's a milkweed, when in fact their larvae cannot eat it and live. And also, Kevin, if you look off to the left, there's a really pretty orange flower, and that's the butterfly weed. It's also in the milkweed family and is a plant that the monarch can use to lay eggs and the caterpillars can feed on and pupate and grow into adults.
I would have never seen that if you had not pointed it out.
Well, it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous orange color. It's hard to miss. Once you see it, it's easily identified as butterfly weed.
So I take it its Latin name wasn't at the tip of your tongue when you got out of bed this morning?
Asclepias tuberosa.
I'm sorry I asked.
Me too.
We reach the summit of the upland ridge that overlooks the fen. We gently descend into a wet, marshy world of waist-high greenery. The calcium-rich mud is thick and sloppy, the kind that can pull ordinary shoes right off your feet. Thankfully, I'm wearing my knee-high rubber wading boots. There's two reasons for this. First, this awful mud. And second...
So Clint, last time you were here, you saw some rattlesnakes. Where were they?
Yeah, I saw one on the south side of the creek, and another one about 60 meters ahead of us on the north side.
Great, thanks.
Great. Thanks.
The prairie fen is prime habitat for the eastern Massasauga, Michigan's only pit viper. My guides tell me it's quite shy, and that the only probable way I'll get bitten is if I step right on one. Not that I'd see it anyway.
I just went in about ankle deep.
Oh, yeah.
There's another hazard straight ahead and at eye level. Botanist Rachel Hackett, who's walking 6 feet in front of me, sees it first.
All right, are you familiar with poison sumac?
A little.
Okay, so this is a poison sumac tree right here. It's related, it's in the same genus as poison ivy, so don't touch it.
Roger that.
Yep.
Rachel, I can't tell you how glad I am that you're walking 6 feet in front of me.
No problem. I have to point out the hazards of the poison sumac to myself, so I might as well point them out to everybody else. I worry about the poison sumac much more than the rattlesnakes.
We reach a small creek flowing out from the main wetland. A small waterfall cascades out of a beaver's dam. A sandhill crane coos nearby. On the other side of the creek, black-eyed Susans pop in miniature sunburst. The Powsheik skipperling loves this particular flower. Now it's time for Clint Pogue to put on his game face. A flutter goes by. It's not our butterfly.
There's one. Nope.
We got some Dorcas coppers flying around. A really common butterfly this time of year. And they give a flash off. It's really similar at first glance to what a Powsheik looks like. But once you see them up close, they look absolutely nothing alike when they're standing still.
Tracking a camouflaged insect with a 1-inch wingspan is a game of patience. We tread lightly, scanning every likely flower. And then...
Oh, Pauschik?
Right here. He's got his backside to you, Rachel. Can you see him?
No, I don't see it yet.
They're really tiny.
It's not on a flower.
No, it's on a blade of grass. Look for the white stripes on its wing. It's going to be sort of right under where this grass is, about 8 inches.
Oh, yes, I do see it.
The Pauschik was once plentiful on the plains of southern Canada and the Dakotas, but it's losing ground to invasive species, agricultural practices, and human encroachment. From time to time, prescribed burns at Big Valley help maintain its habitat, but even fire can't control all of its threats. Dan Kennedy notes that there are some simple things people can do to help the Pauschik skipperling and the prairie fens on which it thrives.
One, learn about that system and share it with your family and friends. Two, is to join a conservation organization or volunteer to do conservation work. And third, specifically for butterflies, you can plant native vegetation in your garden.
Before we turn to leave, I asked Dan to take a few close-ups of a Pauschik as I juggle my microphone and recorder. He politely obliges. But then when an ordinary dragonfly approaches, it's my turn to get up close.
Let's see if Mr. Dragonfly makes some noise here.
Hey, Kevin, stop sticking that microphone in my face.
That's a first in my career.
And probably not the last. For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
And coming up on Current State, Michigan prisoners were once central to manufacturing in our state. Jackson Prison Industries is the title of a new article by Jackson writer and historian Brad Florey. He takes us through the rise and fall of free prison labor in Michigan. That and more after the break on Current State on WKAR. Nice. That song is called My New Old Tune, performed by the Corey Kendrick Trio. They were our guests on a Live Music Friday last month here on Current State. Tomorrow, we welcome Detroit-based singer-guitarist Michelle Held. Michelle performed last month at a Pump House concert in East Lansing. We were not able to have her on the show then, but she will be back in Lansing next week for a gig with Jen Siggett. So tomorrow, we're going to make it happen with Michelle Held. That's Live Music Friday here on Current State. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Republican National Convention in Cleveland ends tonight. A speech by the party's nominee for president, Donald Trump, tops the agenda. Jonathan Osting covers politics for the Detroit News, and he's been with the Michigan delegation at the convention this week. He joins us from Cleveland to talk about what he has seen and heard there over the past few days. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
The big news from last night seems to be the Ted Cruz speech, what he had to say about voting your conscience and some of the boos that he got as well. Have you had a chance to feel out the Michigan delegation for their thoughts about Cruz's address last night?
Yeah, I think for the most part, the Michigan delegation sort of echoed the sentiment you heard on television. People were frustrated. Even some longtime supporters of Senator Cruz were hoping that he would have used that opportunity to formally endorse Donald Trump. The arena was wrapped for most of that Ted Cruz speech. He, of course, is sort of a leader in the conservative movement, which has a very large presence at the convention. It seemed like he was delivering a very solid speech, but towards the end, when it became clear he wasn't endorsing, and when he used that phrase that you just mentioned, vote your conscience, which has become sort of a trigger in this convention, a trigger phrase, things got very tense. There were a lot of boos. I talked to State Rep Ed McBroom, who's a generally very mild-mannered dairy farmer in the UP, and he said he was disgusted by what he saw. He had been a Ted Cruz supporter, but said he couldn't have been more disappointed in somebody he has supported in the past than he was last night in Ted Cruz. Of course, he has his defenders, people who say he spoke about principles. He did say, vote up and down the ticket this fall, even if he didn't mention Donald Trump by name.
Broadly, though, Jonathan, then, are you detecting that anti-Trump sentiment has gone down over the course of these past few days?
Yeah, I mean, certainly here in Cleveland, right? I mean, these are delegates. These are people who are generally pretty loyal to the party. There's a few holdouts we saw on the floor when Donald Trump was nominated on Tuesday. Michigan delegates for John Kasich and Ted Cruz were actually allowed to switch their votes under party rules because they had dropped out, and a handful did not. Trump ended up getting 51 out of 59 delegates from Michigan. So only 8 people decided to hold out, still vote for either Cruz or Kasich. So there certainly is, as is the case usually at conventions, a real push here to unify. And most people seem to be getting on board rallying behind Donald Trump at this point.
You spoke with one of those Cruz delegates, Barbara Bookout of Grand Rapids. What did she have to say?
Yeah, well, she is a, as she calls herself, a constitutional conservative, very much in the Ted Cruz camp. And she said she doesn't think Donald Trump is a constitutional conservative, she left the door open that if he can prove that he does support the Constitution, she might vote for him. Her remarks came a day before, or the same day, at least earlier in the day, before Ted Cruz spoke, but really expressed the very similar sentiment that, Ted Cruz says, vote for people who uphold the Constitution. And he also suggested maybe he's not sure that is Donald Trump at this point, but hopes that Donald Trump will sort of embrace some of the ideals of the conservative movement heading into the general election here.
Jonathan Osting is our guest by phone from Cleveland. He's been covering the GOP National Convention this week for the Detroit News. We spoke with State Senator Joe Hewn yesterday, who was an ardent Trump delegate. He suggested that any anti-Trump sentiment at the convention was merely politics as usual. And he also claimed that Donald Trump is in the process of uniting Republicans because he's taking on issues that neither party has been comfortable, that's his word, comfortable addressing. Here's a little bit more of what Joe Hewn had to say yesterday, and we'll get your response to this. Here he is.
I think our Republican Party has lost sight of making America and our American workers first when they talk about international trade and all of these agreements that essentially, leave the American worker behind. And both parties have been reluctant to address the immigration issue between the United States and Mexico, and particularly building the wall. And it is such a huge pillar and component of the Trump platform that got him through the primary that turned out enormous numbers of new voters that we haven't seen in ever.
Jonathan, my question for you is, how much of the Michigan delegation is talking issues? I mean, Joe Hewn there referred specifically to trade and to immigration. Is there much talk of issues amongst the Michigan delegation?
Well, there's a bit of that. There's been a series of speakers that address the breakfast every morning and have touched on some issues. But, a rallying cry here seems to be more in opposition to Hillary Clinton than necessarily everybody agreeing on specific issues. I mean, the trade one is very interesting. Donald Trump made some comments to the New York Times yesterday about NAFTA, that if he can't renegotiate it, he would try and scrap it. Republican establishment types have traditionally supported these free trade agreements. I think, you know, some of the rank-and-file voters, though, maybe were not on board with some of the more orthodox positions of the Republican Party, and Donald Trump has certainly rallied voters around that, even if some people on the, you know, in the upper echelons of the party are still uncomfortable with some of those positions.
Jonathan, what's so far, what's been the most memorable moment here for you at the convention?
Well, certainly Ted Cruz last night getting those boos was memorable. The previous night when Michigan was queued up to announce its delegate allegation and back Donald Trump, the state was asked to pass and did so, which made for an awkward half hour to an hour before Michigan finally got the chance to come around again and cast its votes for Donald Trump. It did that in deference to New York so that Donald Trump Jr. could announce that his father had secured the nomination. But it certainly a lot of delegates on the floor were confused, and some were upset that Michigan didn't get that chance in the spotlight, had to wait instead.
Remind our listeners what Attorney General Bill Schuette had to say to the gathering.
Yeah, sure. Well, Attorney General Bill Schuette has spoke both to the Michigan delegates and got the chance to actually speak on the convention floor, which was he's the only Michigan speaker who got that opportunity. He only had 3 minutes, but he did actually, you know, really get the convention fired up for an early Monday speaker. He talked specifically. He tried to bring the Berrien County shooting, courtroom shooting the other week, and compare that or link it to some of the other shootings we've seen around the country with police officers being slain, and really touched on a nerve and had some people standing up and clapping, which for an early Monday speech was fairly unusual. As far as his comments to the Michigan delegation, he's supporting Donald Trump. He's trying to make sure that the party is unified, because here in Michigan, the real unknown is how Trump's going to affect candidates lower down on the ticket. State House, of course, is up for grabs this fall, and you're going to see a lot of Republicans working very hard to retain control of the House, depending on how Donald Trump affects races in different districts.
Governor Snyder is not attending the convention, but he has been in town, or he's been around. What do we know about Governor Snyder's activities in Cleveland?
Well, he's probably in town right now. He's coming in for a very short few hours. He's going to address, or he's holding a brunch for Michigan delegates at the Cleveland Public Library. He's going to make some remarks, and then he's going to go meet with Michigan State police troopers who are helping out here in Cleveland, and then he's heading right back to Michigan. He is, you know, over the years, of course, has sort of tended to avoid politics, and in this case, he has said he's not going to be endorsing in the presidential election, and essentially seems to be kind of trying to stay out of this national election debate. He did announce this week his PAC that he formed is for the first time endorsing and starting to donate to state house candidates, as well as U.S. Rep. Tim Walberg, who's probably going to be in a competitive general election matchup this year.
Jonathan, I'm sure you've got lots to keep you busy down there. We're appreciative that you carved out some time to talk with us here this morning. Detroit News reporter Jonathan Oesting in Cleveland for the final day of the Republican National Convention. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Bye.
And a reminder that Current State will talk next week with Democratic Party delegates to their national convention in Philadelphia. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Wagons, farm tools, granite monuments, bricks, and tile. These were all mass-produced products made by Michigan prisoners of the 19th and 20th centuries. It's often been said that prison is big business. In the early days of Michigan state prisons, nearly full employment was reported for the incarcerated. Prisoners labored for numerous private companies, both inside and outside Jackson's prison walls and elsewhere. Brad Florey is a freelance writer who worked for 30 years as a reporter and columnist for the Jackson Citizen-Patriot. His recent Michigan History Magazine article is entitled Jackson Prison Industries, Competition Breeds Controversy. WKAR's Peter Wharf opened his conversation with Brad Florey about how Southern Michigan State Prison was originally not planned for Jackson.
Even before Michigan was a state, had begun to call for the need to have a prison. And it was one of the first things that happened when Michigan obtained statehood was a three-man commission was appointed by the legislature to study what kind of prison Michigan should have and where it should be located. And these three commissioners went, you know, to Pennsylvania, New York, and places like that to look at the best way to, the best systems for running prisons. And they made their recommendations, and they came down to three final sites that they recommended, either Jackson or Marshall or Napoleon. And then when they made the decision, they selected Marshall. And this is, I had never heard of that. I don't think most people knew that. Marshall was selected by this commission. However, the people in Jackson apparently were not willing to play second fiddle to Marshall on this. But however they exerted clout in the legislature in the first year of the legislature existed, I don't know how that worked, but the legislature disregarded the advice of their commission and instead selected Jackson. And it's had just a tremendous influence on the development of the city of Jackson right from the start. There were factories that immediately, almost immediately, came to town and set up inside the prison, using the prison labor.
What were some of the things that they made for private companies?
Private companies would come and contract. As a matter of fact, in the earliest years of the prison, there was no such thing as a warden. There was they called him the agent.
The agent is
the one that was in charge of the prison, and that reflected that the agent was responsible for contracting out the labor to these private companies that, they bid on it. And by the way, right from the start, as you might imagine, that was a system that had trouble with corruption, that different industrialists wanted the labor and they made the bids. The second agent in the history of the prison was relieved of his duties. I don't know all the exact facts, but it was because his relationship to some of the contractors was apparently too close, or things were a little too cozy.
Right, and free labor was to connect to conflict of interest. Free labor, private companies, unfair competition, the notion of kickbacks and those sorts of things made this an unworkable system, not to mention those who felt that this was slave labor.
Right. First of all, even right from the very beginning, there were some I should say the point of having this labor that was twofold. One was that people in that era honestly thought that the inmates should pay for their own cost of incarceration.
They should pay their own way, and the state shouldn't have to pay for people. Right. Shouldn't have to pay for people's wrongdoings.
Exactly right. That's almost like they're getting away with something again. Now we have to support them. That was what they thought in that era.
Right.
And there were some years when the state would put out reports very proudly saying that the state prison in Jackson actually made money last year. That was one of the reasons. And later on it developed, there was an argument that it wouldn't be humane to keep these prisoners locked up all day with nothing to do. And they had, by the way, in those early days, they had what would now seem like a fantastic amount of freedom of movement. There were some of the inmates were outside of the prison walls, in fact.
There's still a modest amount of inmate-made products. What's happening today?
Convicts in Michigan still make license plates. That's the famous one. They do that. They make mattresses that are used in some state facilities, clothing that are used, prison clothing. Things like that are still manufactured, but it's so small compared to what it was in the heyday, the number of jobs that it provides. And all along, the fact that inmates could learn a skill and could get in the habit of working was considered good for them in the long run, and that is still true today.
Brad Flory is a freelance writer who worked for 30 years as a reporter and columnist for the Jackson Citizen-Patriot. We're talking today about his article, Jackson Prison Industries, Competition Breeds Controversy. A very interesting history. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State's recent storytelling event, Pop-Up Stories, featured true first-person accounts of putting down roots. Roxanne Andrews reminded listeners that sometimes your roots aren't where you think they are.
My parents were born and raised in Michigan, and in 1959, they got married, and they figured there was more opportunity out west, and so they traveled across the United States, packed up everything they owned, and moved to California. So that's where I was born. We lived there for probably about 12 years. We had the typical California life. We spent a lot of time outside. We went to the beach. We went to the mountains. We went to Disneyland. And at one point, we lived two blocks away from the Rose Parade route. So instead of watching it on TV, we'd walk the two blocks, and it felt like it was in our backyard. Well, in March 1971, there was kind of a bad earthquake, and it scared my parents. And I overheard them talking, and they said that at least with a tornado, you get a warning. So they decided by June of that year to pack everything up and go home. Well, we didn't know Michigan. It wasn't our home. And so we did that. We packed up and we went. And as we traveled and got closer and closer to Michigan, I realized that things were much different than California. And especially as we got closer to the small town that we were going to live in, which is just north and east of Lansing. And honestly, as an 8-year-old kid, I looked around and I thought, are we in the jungle? Look at all this green and all the trees, and the grass was as tall as I was. And it was a far cry from the manicured lawns of Pasadena. So it was definitely culture shock. It was quiet at night. There were stars. it was foreign to me. So needless to say, I spent my childhood dreaming about going home, going back to California. So eventually I got married, and I was 20 years old. And my husband, who was also born in California, we decided that we would go home. So we packed up everything we owned, and we moved to California. So when we got there, at first I was like, oh man, this is wonderful, I'm home. But then I started realizing that it was much noisier than I remembered. It was much more crowded than I remembered. And where were all the trees that I remembered? So it just was totally different than what my 9-year-old brain had imagined it to be. So we were there, and one night I decided that I was going to go outside and look at the stars. And when I went outside, the sky was pink. The lights from the city just obliterated the stars. And so I started to get homesick for Michigan. And so my husband and I discussed it, and we, after 4 months of living in California, packed everything up and moved home. And I learned a big lesson that where your family is, where your friends are, where your heart is, that's really what home is. So we bought a home, we raised our kids in that small town that I thought was a jungle. That's my story.
Roxanne Andrews there on putting down roots in Michigan without really knowing it. Join us a week from tonight for our next Pop-Up Stories event. We'll be at Valley Court Park in East Lansing for true first-person stories about the call of the wild, These are encounters with the outdoors and with wildlife. All kinds of potential there. It starts at 7 p.m. We have room for a couple more storytellers. Connect with us on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing, or email us at currentstate@wkar.org. We hope to see you there. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, in 11 days, Ingham County voters will narrow a crowded field of candidates vying to become the county's next prosecutor. We've spoken to five of the six who want that job. Tomorrow we speak to number six. Republican Monica Stevens is an assistant state attorney general who works on child protection cases. We'll get to know her. Plus our Live Music Friday guest again, Michelle Held, singer-songwriter out of Detroit. If you missed her Pump House concert in East Lansing last March, she'll be back next week for a show at the Old Town General Store in Lansing with Jen Siggett. All of that and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable. Everything we do ends up there. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. And it's ideal for dog walking, by the way. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter. Follow us at KAR Current State. And on Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. Stay cool. It's Current State on WKAR.